Shri Chaitanya Manobishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dharati Swaparanti Kam. So yesterday, Suvarna Bindu and I went to Kalpali Pomona for book distribution. And when we got there, we saw the spot that we wanted. There was somebody already there. There was a guy already there. He had a table there. But it wasn't an ordinary table like the tables we use. It was kind of more like the table that Nisringa uses. Everybody seen that? You know, Nisringa has these constructed these tables that he uses for rowing his plants. It's a little bit longer, higher, had wheels on the bottom. Okay, so he had that kind of table set up. And from a distance, we couldn't figure it out what was going on. But as we got closer, we could see he had like a model little town on the table. Okay, and the idea was that this was, and it was a working model. It wasn't just like a static model. It was actually working. He had solar panels. Little solar panels, and underneath the table he had like all sorts of wiring and a battery and the whole works. And so basically it was a model showing how a little town works using solar energy. So he had it set up, and he was sitting there on his chair, and you know, not crowds, but at any given time he had at least, right, a couple students coming up, and they go, "Oh, what's this? Please explain your model to us," you know. And he was sitting there trying to act like real nonchalant, but you could tell he was really proud of what he did. And he would explain to him, "Well, you know, this is a town, this is a hospital here, and it's getting powered by the solar panels. And then at night, it automatically has like a transition switch that, because there's no sun, so it'll be powered from the batteries." And all the students were going, "Wow, oh yeah, that's wow, really awesome." And you know, looking at him like, "Wow, you're really somebody, you know." And so it just occurred to me, he's like a little mini Lord Brahma. That's what Lord Brahma's all about, you see. Lord Brahma is just, you know, "Hey, look what I've done." That's, you know, that's his kind of mood to a certain extent. I mean, he's very pious. He's a very elevated soul. But he has that little bit of a sense of, "Okay, everybody, look what I could do," you know, which is okay to a certain extent. But as long as he can keep it in proper perspective, which generally he does a pretty good job of doing, but every now and then he needs a little, Lord Brahma has to be kind of like, you know, put back into the proper way of thinking. So anyways, so that's what Prabhupada's saying in the purport today. Prabhupada's making the point that the real credit, and he kind of repeats it in the purport, he says, "All the planets were originally generated by the Lord, and all the living entities were also born in Brahma." Okay, now in the next sentence, he's basically saying the same thing again. He says, "The material world and all the living entities were already generated in the seedling forms by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and Brahma was to disseminate the same seedlings all over the universe." So then Prabhupada concludes, "The real creation is therefore called Sarga," or what Krishna does, and later on, the manifestation by Brahma is called Vishara. So Prabhupada kind of gives a title to Brahma here inadvertently. He says Brahma was to disseminate the same seedlings all over the universe. So Brahma is like he's a disseminator. That's what he really does. All the heavy lifting, the real work, was already done by Krishna. Brahma is just disseminating. Just like, I give an example. Okay, so imagine that you invented a seed. You didn't just get it from some tree or some plant or something. You, from scratch, you got together a seed which was really potent, and you also got together, you also created land which was really fertile. And then I come along and you give me the seed and you say, "Okay, Bhrigupati, Bhru, or Das, whatever you want to call it, take this seed and put it in the land. Just, you dig a little hole and you put it in there and cover it up and water it, and every day come and check on it, you know, maybe give it a little extra water, and we'll see what happens." Okay, so I do that. I follow your instruction. And I put the seed in there. And sure enough, after like a few weeks' time, a rose bush comes up. And then, you know, you gave me another seed, and I planted that one in another place. And if in a couple months' time, we see, oh, look, it's an apple tree. And I'm thinking, like, wow, I'm really good. I just took this seed, and now here I made a rose bush, and I made an apple tree. And yeah, I get a little credit. You'd have to give me a little credit because I did follow your instruction. I took your seed and I put it in the ground and I did what you told me to do. But the vast majority of the credit, like, you know, 95% or something, you'd have to give to you, the person who invented the seed, created the seed, and created the potent seed and created the fertile land. See, so that's the relationship between Brahma and Krishna. Brahma's doing something. He deserves some credit, and he wants credit. That's why somebody becomes Brahma, you know, generally speaking, because they want a little acclaim. You know, they want a little recognition. So that's part of the, you know, the package or the design, you know, the program of being a Brahma. But that's okay, as long as you can, Brahma is able to keep it in perspective of who, you know, who's really doing the big work. And that's Krishna. That's what Prabhupada's saying here in this purport. The real creation is therefore called Sarga. And later on, Brahma's creation is called Vishaga. So, as I said, Brahma generally does a pretty good job of, you know, keeping it, that understanding in the forefront of his mind. And every now and then, he kind of like loses it and he forgets. And he kind of, you know, starts thinking differently. Let's see. Prabhupada talks about that. Oh, yeah. Well, the classic example of that is when Lord Brahma wasn't sure about, you know, Krishna being the Supreme Personality of Godhead 5,000 years ago when Krishna was performing his pastimes. I'm going to read an excerpt from a lecture Prabhupada gave in 1967 where he says something about that. So he says, Brahma was thinking, he said, oh, how great I am that in my jurisdiction, Krishna, Lord Krishna has come and he is playing like a cowherd boy. How great I am. Krishna has come just like a cowherd boy. So Prabhupada goes. So the instruction is that we speak. Okay, wait. So anyway, Brahma was thinking like that. And so Krishna had to straighten him out. You know, Krishna had to straighten him out. And that's why Krishna, when Brahma stole all the cowherd boys and the calves, Krishna immediately replaced them with expansions of himself. And Brahma kind of, when he came back after a moment of his time, which was a year of time here on earth, he was stunned. He was astounded. Wait a second. I just stole those cows and cowherd boys. How is it possible that they're just back here again? And he was completely bewildered. Well, not completely bewildered, but bewildered. And then he became completely bewildered when Krishna transformed the cows, him expanded as the cows and the cowherd boys into different Vishnu forms. And then Brahma was completely bewildered, right? And he offered those amazing prayers that are found in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 14, in which he explains that, you know, somebody might say they know Krishna, you know, whatever. As far as I'm concerned, I understand practically nothing about Krishna. So he kind of learned his lesson. There was another occasion where, I can't remember how it, you know, what led up to it, but Brahma decided to visit Krishna in Dwarka. So the way Prabhupada tells the story, he says that, you know, Brahma arrived and he gave his card. Prabhupada said, that's what they do in India. He gave his card to the doorman and said, please tell Krishna I'm here to see him. So the doorman took his card and went and came back and said, Krishna wants to know which Brahma. And Lord Brahma was kind of like surprised, you know, to hear that from the doorman. So that he said, well, tell him it's the Lord Brahma with four heads. And then he thought, tell him it's the Lord Brahma who's the father of the four Kumaras. He thought that was a better way to introduce himself, because even though the four Kumaras are his children, they're considered like, in some sense, superior to Lord Brahma because they're so elevated spiritually. So he said, tell him it's the father of the four Kumaras. So he went, the doorman went and came back and said, okay, come on, I'll see you. So when Lord Brahma was in the presence of Krishna, Krishna said, so, to what do we owe the honor of this? Well, you know, I don't know exactly how he said it, but he said, so you've come to see me, so you have some concern or something you want to, you know, talk about? And Lord Brahma says, yeah, I do, but first I have some doubt I have some doubt which I'd like you to dispel. And Krishna said, okay, sure. So Lord Brahma said, so the doorman asked me, which Lord Brahma? Is there more than one Lord Brahma? And Krishna said, oh yeah, there's so many Lord Brahmas. He said, I'm calling them. So Krishna called them, and immediately all these Lord Brahmas appeared in the room. None of them could see each other. Lord Brahma, our Lord Brahma could see all of them, but they couldn't see each other. And they were, some of them had, as described, some of them had, you know, Lord Brahma has four heads, so probably in the narration, so some of them had 400 heads, 4,000 heads, I think it even says 4 million heads. Archita shaking his head, yes, so, you know, inconceivable. And Lord Brahma could see all this, and he was like, oh my God, you know. And then, you know, he understood what his position was. So Lord Brahma, as I said, sometimes, generally speaking, he's pretty good. He kind of is able to keep a handle on it, understanding his position and Krishna's position. Every now and then he kind of forgets. So Krishna gives him some pastime like that to help him remember. So that's one point. Now another point that comes up in this purport is, that Prabhupada makes when he's narrating this pastime, is that when we hear about really inconceivable things like that, we have to accept them as they're presented in detail. And he makes this comment, very interesting comment. This is an excerpt from this a lecture from the 1966. Prabhupada says, so here's the instruction. He says, we speak of God as unlimited, but when he makes some manifestation of unlimitedness, we take it in a different way. But actually, it is not the fact. If God has unlimited potency, and that's basically when he says, actually, it's not the fact. Actually, we shouldn't do that. He says, if God has unlimited potency, he can do anything and everything. That is unlimitedness. We should not restrict God with our speculative mind that, how is it that, oh, four-headed Brahma, 10,000-headed Brahma, how is it possible? Prabhupada goes, if God likes, he can make millions of headed Brahma. Otherwise, there's no meaning to unlimited. He can show anything and everything. We should accept. He says, if we think that these are all stories, and then he goes, they're not stories. He says, do you think Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is speaking some stories, some fabricated stories to get his followers? Do you think like that? So in other words, there's a tendency, you know, if you did a bit of a survey, if you went out on the street and talked to people and said, do you think God is unlimited? And they would agree, but they won't agree with the details. And even among, as devotees, sometimes we could think like that, oh yeah, Krishna is unlimited, he can do anything. But then, you know, when we hear a particular thing, you go, oh, wait a second, that's pretty far out. But Prabhupada's saying here, we should take it as it's being described, it's coming in parampara, you know, being presented by Lord Chaitanya, who we're accepting as the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, so we should take it, you know, to the detail, you know, very to the minute detail, like that. And Prabhupada, in another place, actually here in Los Angeles, there was some devotees. There's one instance where there were some devotees who were having difficulty doing that. And, you know, I'm told, because I've kind of talked about this with different devotees, they weren't totally nonsense devotees, but they were having some difficulty accepting some of the, you know, things in the books that were really inconceivable. And they went to see Prabhupada right here up in his room, and they were presenting to Prabhupada that, you know, they're getting challenged when they go out preaching that, you know, about some certain sections of the, you know, the books. And I think they were kind of exaggerating, you know, as to what was it, what they were actually experiencing. But they gave the example of the Ugrasena, Maharaj Ugrasena, having 10 billion bodyguards or something. You know, they gave a couple of examples. And Prabhupada said, oh, so they're just asking about that part of the books? They're not asking questions about other part of the books? And, you know, Prabhupada was kind of skeptical. Like, he felt that they were just kind of trying to find fault, which I think they were. But anyway, this is what Prabhupada said. When he could detect their attitude, he said, our position is that if some portion we cannot understand, it is our incapability. And Prabhupada goes on to say, unless we have got this faith, we cannot use these Puranas. In the Puranas, there are many such statements. So that's, you know, when we come across something that seems like really far out, we just have to understand that, okay, it's not, the defect is not with what I'm hearing, what I'm being presented with. The defect is me. I'm incapable of understanding it at this point in time. Just like even in today's verse, it talks about, it says here, Lord Brahma saw that the lotus on which he was situated was spread throughout the universe. Well, we're used to thinking of that lotus as the picture, well, oh, here it is, yeah. There's a picture on the cover there, you know, it's coming out of the navel of Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, it's in a particular place, but now we're hearing now it's spread throughout the universe. One thing that helps us a lot, we tend to gloss over the details. We don't think about it, and that makes it, you know, just goes right by us. But look, here's the Tulsi plant, okay? Imagine if this Tulsi plant started growing and grew to the size of this room. That would be pretty far out, right? Okay. Imagine that it grew not just to the size of this room, but expanded to the size of the entire city of Los Angeles. Wow. So this lotus flower, we're hearing here that the lotus flower is being spread throughout the universe. That's even, I mean, even more inconceivable. It's, you know, it's in one place at one point, coming out of the navel of Lord Brahma, and now we're hearing that this lotus is spread throughout the universe. So, okay, but so aside from this point of, okay, it's our incapability, is there anything else I could say to help us, get a handle on this? Yeah. In the Padma Purana, there's a statement Prabhupada was very fond of quoting. How's it go? Takshri Krishna Namadi, Nabhaved Guraim Indri, Seva Nukhe Hijivado Svayameva Spadathya, that Krishna and this entire philosophy, when Prabhupada says Krishna, he's not just talking about Krishna, this is Krishna's philosophy. Krishna's philosophy, his worldview, his picture of reality, and him are non-different. So Krishna consciousness can't be understood by the blunt material senses. Sevan mukha hi jivado svayameva spadatira. It's understood by the senses when they're purified senses when they're engaged in the service. That same point is reiterated or repeated in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Sukham atyantikam yatad buddhigrayam atindriya. That it describes that when one is in samadhi, actually Krishna consciousness is properly understood when you're in samadhi. And that samadhi is, according to that sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, one experiences boundless transcendental happiness. And the second phrase is even more important, buddhi grayam atindriyam, through transcendental senses. So the senses it's not a different set of senses. There's only one set of senses. But when the senses that we have are contaminated by matter, we perceive the material world. And when the senses that we have are purified, then we can experience spiritual reality. See? So if we're finding it difficult, when we come across these inconceivable things, just remind yourself of that. What do I expect? I've got materially covered senses. My senses at this stage are incapable of understanding spiritual reality. Just like if you got the flu, you're sick. You can't expect to experience life like a healthy person while you're a sick person. Or when you're asleep, say, for instance. When you're asleep, you're kind of either totally out of touch with reality. Sometimes when I'm sleeping, I kind of know I'm sleeping. I know I'm dreaming. And sometimes I don't. But in either of those two cases, I'm not understanding very much, if anything, about what's going on in the wake world. See? So just like a sleeping person can't understand what's going on in the awake world, a person in material consciousness can't really understand. He can get some idea, but from intellectual understanding. But as far as experiencing what's really going on, no. Your senses, you have to elevate your senses to the transcendental platform, and then we'll understand. It has to be revealed. So that's another point that comes out from this verse in Prabhupada. Maybe give you one more reference and support that point, and then we will end the class. So this is from a purport to the second canto, chapter 9, text 1. Prabhupada says, the living entities are illusioned by the will of the Lord because they wanted to become like Him. The living entities are illusioned by the will of the Lord because they wanted to become like Him. Like a person who thinks of becoming a king without possessing the necessary qualification. When the living entity desires to become the Lord Himself, he is put in a condition of dreaming. And dreaming that he is the king. Goes on here. The first sinful will of the living entity is to become the Lord, and the consequent will of the Lord is that the living entity forget his factual life and thus dream of the land of utopia where he may become one like the Lord. So it's like a dream. Material consciousness is like a dream. And in the dream, you don't experience what's going on in the real world around you. Same way, we're like in this dream. You know, and as long as we're being influenced by Maya, it's like being a dream. But when we come out of the dream, then we'll be able to properly appreciate these different things that sound inconceivable. They're actually, you know, spiritual realities, but in our present state, we can't understand them. So I'll stop there. Does anybody have any question? Ananda Kirtan, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. You said that Lord Brahma is sometimes proud of his service, like, look what I can do. And then you gave the example of the Brahma Vimohana Lila. Yeah. My understanding was that Lord Brahma was just confused if Krishna was the same as Vishnu. Because Lord Brahma, as we were reading right here in this canto, Lord Brahma spoke to Vishnu. He was enlightened by Vishnu, how to create the universe. And then when he saw Krishna, he was unsure if that little boy playing with other little boys was that same Vishnu that he spoke to at the beginning of the universe. So that's why he was confused. Not that he himself thought that he was supreme. Lord Brahma didn't think he himself was supreme.
Yeah, maybe that wasn't the best example.
And also, where does it say that Lord Brahma was a little bit, or is a little bit proud of his service?
Well, he's... Lord Brahma, generally speaking, is not a pure devotee. This Lord Brahma is supposedly a pure devotee, but the general position of Lord Brahma is that he's not a pure devotee, and he has some material desire. That's why somebody takes birth, you know, gets the position of Lord Brahma, and that part of that material desire is, you know, that pride. It's more than just that he really gets off on making things, like a kid with an erector set or something like that. No, he feels some... You know, look what I've done. There's a certain aspect of that there. And that's why somebody aspires for the position of Lord Brahma. I can't think of a Shastric reference right away, but I know Prabhupada has said that, you know, generally Lord Brahma, there's some tinge of material desire there. Archita Prabhu wanted to say something.
Well, earlier in this canto, in his own prayers, he's praying to the Lord
Right. One last thing, and then I'll turn the mic over to Savasi. He's going to read us something about Ramdas. So, on this point of samadhi, you know, when you hear that word, you might think, you have the preconception of samadhi means you got to sit in a lotus position, and, you know, like that, with the eyes half open. And no, it is. I mean, that's a type of practice that some yogis do to enter into samadhi. It's not recommended for this age, because I just can't do it. You know, those yogis who were doing that, they would meditate for 10,000 years. And, you know, some of them, they weren't even breathing. I mean, it's impossible. It's impossible for people of this age to enter into samadhi by that process. But there is a process by which we can enter into samadhi. And that Prabhupada describes that here. In the 10th canto, he says... the word kriyashu, meaning by manual labor or by work, is important in this verse. One should engage in practical service to the Lord. And he uses the example of book distribution, but that could be expanded to any service, okay? Practical service to the Lord. He says that Kriyashu Yach Chach Chadanabindayo, such activities will always remind the devotees of the Lord's lotus feet. By fully concentrating on, once again, he's using the example of book distribution here, but I think it could be expanded upon any practical service. By being fully, by fully concentrating on some practical service to the Lord, Prabhupada says, one is fully absorbed in Krishna. This is samadhi. So by being fully absorbed in our service, that's samadhi. So that's the way for us to enter into that samadhi. It's not something that's inaccessible. It's accessible by the very, you know, means of what we're doing, devotional service. Just becoming fully absorbed, fully concentrating and focused on our service. When Krishna's pleased by our service attitude, then he reveals himself to us, you know, we're in samadhi and we understand the whole philosophy. Okay, thank you very much. Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare. Okay. We just wanted to say a few things this morning about Ram Dass Prabhu. He was a devotee here in New Dwarka. He came here in early 80s, I think about 1980. And we just like to say a few words. Today is the day that he disappeared, so we just want to kind of remember him here. He was a very nice devotee, good stature, very sincere devotee in execution of Krishna consciousness. He was the head pujari here. He was in several departments before then. But he did come to Krishna consciousness in about 1980. He was from the East Coast, came to the West Coast to look for a higher consciousness, and ran into the devotees in downtown Los Angeles. They gave him a nice card, invitation card to come to the temple and go to the Sunday feast program. So he did come. He really enjoyed it. They said, why don't you stay for a couple of days? And he never went back. He stayed the whole time. So about 1980 he came. Never met the devotees before, but just came, was associated with the devotees for 3 days, and decided he'd want to become a devotee. So in the course of that, he was a talented person. He was actually kind of a people person. And so they had him doing PR work, legal work, things of that nature, interacting with the city about different permits and things like that. So he was very active in that way. He was an elderly person compared to a lot of devotees. He was about like in his 40s, I believe, when he first came. So he was elderly, more than, you know, sometimes 20 years older than a lot of devotees in the temple. So he was like a father figure. His stature was a big man. He was a very big man, powerful looking, and very athletic kind of individual. He was very caring to the devotees. He was really into naturopathic medicine. So a lot of devotees would come to his home. He got into Eastern medicine, you know, Chinese, you know, this, you know, those teas, right? Has anybody had any of those teas? Yeah? You can barely swallow them. They're these herb teas that you cook, you know. And if you've ever gone to Chinatown, you got some acupuncture. They tell you to drink certain kind of teas. The smell is awful. The taste is horrific. But I guess it works. So anyway, he was into that. A lot of devotees went to him for those health reasons. So he took that opportunity to associate with devotees and preach to them. He helped a lot of devotees. At that time, when he was a temple head pujari, there were a lot of ladies that were doing the deity worship, and they needed a lot of attention. So he was very good at giving them attention and taking care of them very nicely so they could do their service. And he actually kept them really in good situation very nicely. Ram Dass was one of those individuals that, because he was a big man, you know, everything he did was big, so he'd have big bag. He'd always have some kind of a cloth bag on his shoulder. And he had a lot of goodies in there. A lot of times he put a lot of maha prasad in his bag. He was like a Santa Claus almost, you know. you could just, you know, if he saw you walking down the street, he could put his big old hand, it was like this huge, a big old hand in that bag, and he'd come out with a huge samosa. And he would give that samosa to a devotee, and they'd be in ecstasy. Or he could put his big old huge hand in his bag, and it'd come out with like burfi, or some beautiful little sweet that was just offered to Krishna. And it was such a unique way of interacting with devotees on a daily basis. That's what was so wonderful about it. That was his relationship. And he was he became very famous on this block because of that. Like, you just imagine if one of you starts having a bag, and in that bag you pull out a lot of wonderful little goodies. And, you know, in those days and these days, we get into Maya periodically. And then all of a sudden you have this nice person, big statured person, big smile. And, you know, he, as Amalabhati Maharaj told me, he said that what he remembers about him is that he would always say, "Yes, indeed." That was his little line. If you'd say something to him, he'd go, "Yes, indeed." So he was that kind of individual, really outgoing, beautiful person, really liked by everyone, literally, all of us. We just completely liked him as being a person that he was. And he was very giving, and as I said, that big bag was full of goodies, and he was always giving whenever he met you. If he had it in there, he'd give it to you. He was the kind of individual that would, if there was any kind of a difficulty in the Pujari department, he took care of it. If someone didn't show up for cooking, he'd cook for the deities. If somebody didn't show up for an artik, he was there to cover that artik. He was like that kind of person. And sometimes he would have a lack of sleep. So sometimes it wouldn't be unusual to go. He used to live in the building there where Nakatma lives. He lived in that building. So it wouldn't be unusual sometimes to go in the back area where they have the parking structure. He'd be sitting in his car sleeping. I think he was ready to go somewhere. He'd get in his car, he'd sit down, and then he'd be like passed out. He just didn't get very much sleep. It was dangerous, actually. We kind of always try to encourage him, get some sleep. But he was that kind of individual. So, yes. And things like that were really something that reminded us of Ram Dass and what a wonderful character he had in terms of devotional service and Krishna consciousness. Very surrendered, very a clean person, very pukka, brahminical. Pukka person, always very clean, orderly. You never heard him really say anything like derogatory. Every now and then something would happen, but as a general person, you never heard derogatory things come from him. If you would speak about somebody, and he would just like, "Okay, I'll see you guys later." You know, if there was a conversation about, he'd kind of like leave the conversation, "Okay, I'll see you later. Adibol." And he didn't really want to interact in that particular fashion, which is really amazing, very amazing. And considering how many difficulties arise in the course of living within a community with, a couple hundred devotees. So that's pretty unusual. And he would counsel a lot of people. They would come to him for counseling about Krishna conscious life and even about their own personal life. And so he was very good at that. And that kind of individual is extremely important in a community, especially of this size. So he helped a lot of devotees. In the course of being in the temple, he was an older person, as I mentioned. He did develop a heart problem. And from that problem, he had to stop doing his service in the temple here. And he more or less had to kind of like retire. And we put him in an apartment across the street, 3765. And his wife took good care of him. And they lived pretty peacefully. It came to a particular point, though, where his health was getting worse. And in the course of getting worse, they decided that they should go to India. We'll just wait for that. Okay, so they decided to go to India, so the temple paid his way, him and his wife, and they stayed in Vrindavan, and they lived there, you know, for a couple of years. And in the course of that time, his health was getting worse and worse. And eventually, of course, it came to that particular point where he was going to actually pass away. But even in the course of being there in Vrindavan, I recall that I'd go to Vrindavan in those days, and for different things, meetings and stuff. So he would invite me over to his apartment. Tadit and I had the pleasure of going there. And he would cook for us, even though he was in the condition he was in. He would cook, and it was great. He'd cook some wonderful preparations in ghee and great chapatis. I remember his chapatis. He was a great chapati maker. So he was that kind of person, even though his health was deteriorating very rapidly. Still, he was able to get up and try to serve the devotees that he knew and that we served together with. And that was his character. Now, you know, it's we said this many times now, it's not an easy thing to go someplace knowing that you're going to die there. It's a pretty hard thing. You know, I thought about this on several occasions. You know, taking that ride from Delhi in a you know, taxi, and then going down Bhaktivedanta Marg, that road that goes to the Vrindavan temple, Krishna Balaram Mandir. And there, that's it. You're going to be there, and that's what you're doing. Now, that takes a lot of courage. It takes a lot of courage to do that. Ram Dass did it. He showed his courage. And I really respect him for that particular point, because it's like if someone told you, well, you have months to live, or you have a year to live, what would you do? Sometimes in the material world, they have like maybe some kind of movie like that, and everybody's going to go to Disneyland. They're going to go, you know, someplace over here or over there. They're going to make sure that they see everything of the world that they can before they have to pass from this world. But Ram Dass, he forsake that and directly went to Vrindavan. And there he stayed, waiting to leave this planet and hoping to go back home, back to Godhead. And so it's not easy to die in Vrindavan. It's a very sweet place, but it's a place that really demands a lot of you in terms of your mindset, your Krishna consciousness, and your strength to be able to go through that process. It takes a lot. And so he did show that. He stayed. It was a very auspicious passing. Kumari, his wife, was there. She helped him pass away from this material world. And, you know, in that case, we could see that he had a lot of mercy. I don't have Chi Kala Gya, so I don't exactly know where Ram Dass Prabhu is. But I believe just the course of the way he lived, he either had to take another birth and go back to Godhead, or he went there at that same time. So I really think that was his position. So very exemplary devotee, lived out his life in Krishna consciousness, went to that place where auspicious place to pass from this earth, but a very difficult transition, not easy. We've seen some devotees that tried to do this, and there's a story about a devotee, a Prabhupada disciple, we won't mention his name, but he went to Vrindavan to pass away. He also had cancer, and he went there, and it's not funny, but it just gives you an idea. He was a very nice devotee. I had a lot of interaction with him on book distribution and things. So he went there. He had brain cancer, and he had to go there. And in the course of that, going to Vrindavan, he actually freaked out. One day, he just got up and started walking down the Bhaktivedanta Marg towards Delhi. He said, I got to go to Delhi. I got to get out of here. I got to go to Delhi. And the devotees ran out in the street and they had to capture him. They had to get him. And then they took him back to the temple, and they convinced him to stay. And then he peacefully passed away from this world. So that's the auspiciousness of leaving this planet in the association of devotees. That when it's ready to go, it's not easy. It's very challenging, but to speak of here in Vrindavan. But the devotees are so sweet, they're so nice, that they had to run out. This one devotee told me he had to run out into the street down Bhaktivedanta Mark and snag him. And he didn't go willingly. He didn't go willingly. They had to take him a little bit forceful. And finally he calmed down. Because he knew he was ready to pass. He knew it. So this is very glorious that Ram Dass Prabhu could leave this planet in that particular situation. And he went to that place where it's very auspicious but very challenging. So that's a little bit about Ram Dass. Anything else anybody would like to say? If you have any interaction with Ram Dass? Yes.
Ram Dass would grind up their flour and make their own flour for the deities.
Yes, he was one of those Prabhus that would do that.
You might say he was a little bit of a health nut. He would grind his own flour for the deities, of course.
My memories of Ram Dass was that when we were at Fullerton, we opened a preaching center there in Fullerton, and he would cook for us. He was just like a father, or you can say like a mother too. And he was really much older than us, so he was always looking up to him as a father or an older brother. But one day, he wanted to go on Sankirtan, and we went to one spot, and he approached this boy or man, almost like my size, and Ram Dass is really big, so he will bend down to talk to people like that. And after offering the magazine, he asked this person, "Would you like to give a donation?" And this person said, "Sure." And he gave him 25 cents. And then Ram Dass looked at me and smiled. He said, "He's already working his way out back to Godhead." So he had that sincere. He was not like cynical or sarcastic. "Why are you just giving 25 cents?" He was appreciating that. Very kind. He's working his way out back to Godhead now. Also, the scriptures mentions that anyone who leaves his body in Vrindavan is his last birth. So definitely we can see that for the service that he did to this temple, especially to Sisi Rumini Dwarkadish, he was rewarded. He also used to stand right there in that where Prem Sankirtan is and chant the prayers of Lord Shiva. He will just recite the prayers of Lord Shiva there. And good memories of him. Whenever you wanted to go and see him, it was not that easy because he was always surrounded by so many people in his office. I would see a lot of shoes, so there's no way to talk to him now. You have to wait. Then you go another time, a lot of people all the time. Everybody wanted to talk to him, all those devotees who were doing service at the Pujari room. So, Ram Dass Prabhu ki. Yeah.